Bookmarks and Dog Ears, a podcast on the love of reading by Elsbeth van der Ploeg and Berry Vugts.
Our guest is Maria Carmen Punzi, PhD researcher into menstrual health and social change at Rotterdam School of Management. Welcome, Maria Carmen.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Where do you prefer to do it?
Reading.
Whichever you prefer, yeah.
It's about reading, Elsbeth?
I think it's about reading.
Okay. Yeah. Are you thinking about where you like to read?
No, I was thinking about the instructions that you gave me before. I was like, where do I prefer doing it? Mm-hmm. Reading. Yeah.
So is it at home? Work. We're getting there.
I was like, what's happening? even with the instructions, I was completely lost. I was like, what's happening?
You're looking at us like, what are you asking me? Well, it is a podcast about reading.
It is. Yeah. And I actually only, I mostly read in bed before going to sleep. And then on trains, on the NS trains.
We haven't had in bed a lot yet, actually.
Really?
Most people don't, I think, like to read in bed that we've spoken to so far.
I do. Maybe it's because of the question.
But we haven't
people
asked
don't
want to
answer with.
Yeah. In bed, yeah. And it's too much.
True.
Yeah.
So how do we visualize this? You have this bedstand with a pile of books on it.
That's exactly it. Yes, it's actually not even a proper bedstand. It's a holder for blankets that I repurposed as a bedstand.
That's creative.
And there's a couple of different books on it, but usually I'm mostly reading one book at a time.
Okay. And then, do you go to bed extra early to have enough time to read, or do you manage to read two pages before you fall asleep?
Well, I don't really, I mostly go to bed when I go to bed, and then I always have to read at least 10 minutes. I think it's been a habit since I was, I don't know, perhaps 7 years old. I have a hard time sleeping if I haven't read a little bit before.
It's like a sleeping way to get to sleep.
Yeah.
Do you also find yourself waking up with the book still somewhere on your bed? You always put it back.
No, I always put it back.
Oh, that's very good. And since you were 7, is that when you more or less started your reading career?
Yeah, I think I learned to read when I was 5, I think. That's when I started elementary school. But really proper books, I think about, I was 7, 6, 7. And I immediately was very much into it. So I was really, there's a lot of pictures of me with my younger brothers next to me, and I'm there in the book, and I'm not really paying a lot of attention to the rest.
Oh, that sounds really nice, because this is in Italy, right?
Yeah.
And so these books were given to you by your parents, or they came from your school? Do you remember?
So I think it was a mix. I remember one of my dad's favorite quotes is, a book is never a gift, as in you can always ask for books. That it doesn't count as a gift. You don't have to wait for your birthday.
Ah, that's a very good rule.
It's good to remember.
Yeah. And I think it really struck the chord with me because I still remember after so many years. But also I had a high school, an elementary school teacher that understood that I was really into reading as well. So she was really encouraging me to pick books from the school library and just kind of read. Yeah.
Mm. And then when you grew up, you had this, did your parents have a lot of books at home that you could just pick? And did you read the same stuff as your siblings did, or was it different?
Yeah, so I have 4 younger male siblings, so we definitely didn't read the same things. They were mostly reading fantasies, and at least the first of my brothers and the others didn't really like reading a lot. But my parents have lots of books. I think I never got near my dad's books because they were too complicated for me at the time. But I did read quite a little bit of yeah, I guess like English literature a little bit simplified. So I think I was quite young when I read like Pride and Prejudice and like,
oh, really?
Yes, and the Jane Austen, but that's my mom's influence for sure. And then I definitely got into the Harry Potter and the Twilight of it all.
Unavoidable.
Unavoidable. And actually, I influenced my mom into it. So that's interesting how.
Into the Harry Potter. Thing.
Well, Harry Potter, she was already reading before I started reading it. But all the other more like fangirl books, she started reading after I brought it into the house.
What is fangirl book? I don't know what it is.
Well, it's books that kind of like started this fandom. So all these fans like would gather around it. I would spend a lot of time online, like in these forums before social media was a thing, just discussing the books and waiting for the next book to be released, specifically when it came to Twilight, because I was like 34, 14. Yeah.
Ah, yeah. That's actually quite a good feature of those kinds of books, right? The talking about it online amongst yourselves.
Yeah, I mean, and it was so fun because there was a whole like movement of, and I mostly was in online spaces that were like Italian speaking, let's say, because I was still a bit too young to interact in English. But there was so much anticipation for the movies and for the next book, and there was fan fiction writing, so like fans like writing their own versions. I was writing fan fictions myself about Twilight,
really?
So it was a whole world. It would consume all your time. I think if social media had been there at the time, I wouldn't have found time to, you know, engage with these communities online.
You were born under a lucky.
I had lots of fun.
Yeah, oh, that's great. And it was mostly fiction then, or also nonfiction?
Yeah, I think until I was 16, 17 or so, I mostly was reading fiction. It was really a mix between indeed those more like urban fantasies and then a little bit of English literature, all the like Pollyanna and Anne of Green Gables.
American still don't know classics.
I don't know the English translations because I read them all in Italian. But and then at some point, I think when I turned like 18 or so, I started reading more like this, what we would now call personal development, and at the time we were calling the self-help books. I remember a few like The Happiness Project, and then I started reading Brené Brown. So I shifted to nonfiction for a while, but I have to say that slowed down my novel reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And because
how's the balance nowadays?
I am back into mostly fiction reading. Which I think, it's so much nicer. I think it's just that I consume a lot of nonfiction content in podcasts by now and online, you know. So like what I watch on YouTube or what I read, what I listen to in podcasts.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So I can make most of my reading times reading novels.
Great. And you manage to make time for it as a busy PhD researcher?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think... for me, it's really a priority to read. It's it's always played a huge role in my life. When I was young, I also wanted to be a writer, and you know, I think a lot.
Not anymore.
It's still there.
Okay,
it's
good.
Still
okay.
There. Yeah, I think, but I think it takes a lot of passion and grit and discipline to be a fiction writer. To be honest, I don't know if I. If I'll make the time for it, but hopefully, maybe one day.
Can do a PhD, who knows? That discipline must be there.
So. Exactly, some discipline must be there. But it's just like reading has always given me a lot. Like it's always created lots of internal and external worlds for me. And so for me, it's a priority to make space for it, especially since I have to do so much reading for work. I want to balance it out with like some pleasure reading, let's say.
Yeah.
Sounds very healthy to me. You brought a few books. Let's leave it to you. Which one is the first one you want to talk about and why it's so dear to you?
Yeah, I guess we can start chronologically with Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which was the first novel I remember reading. I'm not 100% sure if it was really the first, but it definitely made an impression. I even remember a place outside of my home where I was reading. I think I brought it on a family trip, which means I was really, you know, into it.
Yeah, it really made an impression. Huh?
Yeah, it also inspired my first fiction story, which was basically a copycat of
Little
Women.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. Some writers actually write complete paragraphs from other books just to practice rhythm, etc. But continue, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's all right. I think it's, I remember loving it, and I am not 100% sure why I loved it back then. Mm-hmm. I think now, thinking about it and having rewatched the 2019 film remake, I realized that in this book there's a lot of the person that I've become over the years, because in the end it's really about, it's a book about women, mm-hmm. sisters.
When was it written?
I think end of the 1800s.
I think, yeah, actually I'm not 100% sure, but yeah, end of the, well, or a little bit before, maybe.
I could check.
Middle of the 1800s.
Let's see if it says.
It's set during the Civil War, but of course that doesn't mean the Civil War in America, so 1860, 1865, but doesn't mean it has,
I think,
to be.
First published 1868.
Oh, okay, so yeah. So during the Civil War.
Yeah.
So it was a really...
it's nice that you enjoyed it as a child.
Yeah. If I think about it now, I'm like, I don't know how. And of course, I read it in Italian, so that was much easier. But I think I just remember identifying with these girls that were not yet in the romantic stage of their life. Because, of course, there's marriage in the book, and then in the books that follow this. But I think it was so interesting for me, because the most important relationships in their lives were the ones with their sisters and with their mom.
Yeah.
And I think for me that just resonated. I was so young. I mean, romance didn't really even play a role in my mind. Definitely not in my life yet. Mm-hmm. And I think I really identify with this desire to leave a mark in the world already. Like, I think that's, you know, Jo, that's what she wants. Like, she wants to have a remarkable life. Yeah. That's why she says, I wish I was born a boy, because she thinks that as a woman, she will not have that chance.
She's the main character.
Yeah, she is. She is, absolutely. And I think the writer herself, like, she puts a lot of her own story in the character. Yeah. And it's a character that wants to be a writer. It's a character that doesn't really want to get married, although in the end she does get married. But she, and that's a bit of a spoiler, but hey, it's like a lot of years later, she creates a very unconventional family, because she basically creates a sort of orphanage where with her husband she hosts a lot of different children. So in a way, she was a revolutionary
character.
Not
a typical nuclear family structure.
That's, and especially nice. For this time of, you know, 1868, like that's
yeah,
incredibly
very modern,
forward-looking.
Huh? Yeah, she's this really modern character, or sort of, yeah, example maybe of how you can also be a young woman.
Well, she says to one of her sisters when the sister is about to get married, like, you will get bored of him in 2 years and we will forever be interesting.
So you remember very well, or did you reread it?
I looked it up. But I think it's so fun, because of course it's a very black and white approach, and you know, I think there's much gray in between, and men can be wonderful, interesting people. But I just think it's such a fun. If I remember, you know, for myself as a very young, even preteen, the idea that, you know, Indian women will still play a huge role in your life. That's not what I saw at the time, you know, because around me there were mostly families and nuclear families, including my own. And I didn't see a lot of female friendships in the people that were 20, 30, 40 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And now if I think about my life right now and how big of a role women play in my professional and personal life, I think, oh, I guess I created my own little women world.
Yeah, I'm a little bit astonished that at this age you read this novel. You know, is this a cultural thing? Because I don't think I was reading more than children's books at that age.
I was definitely given this. You know, I think it was, I know my aunt, this used to be her favorite book as well.
That's nice.
Yeah, so I think that, I don't know if it was my aunt, my grandma, my mom, someone must have given it to me. I don't think I just went and picked it up from the library myself. Mm. And perhaps I don't remember, but maybe I discussed it also with them so that they explained a bit more. And I remember, for example, all the war context, it completely went over my head. I didn't even know what was going on, so I should reread it in that sense.
I can imagine. It's also a bit more in the background in the book that this family is really the main topic. And as a kid, you probably wouldn't pick up on that. No, I can imagine.
Exactly.
I was wondering, you said, I remember very well, physically, the place where I was when I read this book, mm-hmm. does this hold good for other books that are dear to you as well, or is it just this typical, this one?
Well, to be honest, I think I really also read most of the books I read in my childhood room, bedroom, which is by now been taken over by my youngest brother. So it doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, at least not in that way, because I always used to read before bed. So I guess I remember, for example, reading a specific Harry Potter book, I think the fifth. And it was like midnight, and I was like reading until the middle of the night for me. And I was also texting with the friends that were reading it at the same time, because it was the day after it came out in Italy.
That's a new version of discussing your books.
Yeah, indeed.
Texting because, your friends.
Yeah, books are relational, right? I mean, it's sure. they are such an amazing conversation starter, and they give you so many ideas. And I remember... And I've always had also this desire to reflect on them. Like even when I was very young and still this age, like 8, 9, I found back a diary I had where I rated the books I read.
Really?
I gave them like 3, 4 stars, which is what I do now with Goodreads, you know?
I think
it's like 20 years later. And it's so fun. And I even wrote a couple sentences about how I felt about the characters.
Oh, that's really nice.
Wow. When you read that young.
Yeah, I have physical proof of this, so I can send pictures.
But very nice.
And it's something that makes me realize I was always like a bit meta about books as well. Like I was comparing them, I was thinking about them. Perhaps it's because I also used to love writing, and therefore I was kind of really fascinated.
Language.
Yeah,
exactly. To see how it worked.
Yeah.
Do you also have a specific love for the physical object, or? Is it just the text that interests you?
So actually, I'm not really... I like having books, so I don't really read much on my e-book, on my e-reader. But I'm not really particularly close to them.
No first editions or science copies?
No, because for me, it's like I need to be able to bring them around and like, you know, having... I'm not precious with them.
They don't have to stay in a pristine condition.
No, exactly. Mm. Especially... No, especially because I like to also borrow them or lend them from friends.
Right.
So I know they might get lost in the meantime. Sometimes it happens.
Yeah. So you probably prefer to use the physical book, right? In print.
Yeah, I do. That's nicer. Also before going to bed, I think.
It's better for your eyes as well, huh?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So far, that's most of our podcast guests. They like the physical copy.
They like the
copy.
Print, yeah.
Do you also... I mean, you said I lend books. Do you buy them as well? Or what systems do you use to get them?
Yeah, I definitely buy them. Although since I've been I've moved a couple times in the last years, I'm like, I don't want to have more books. It's just they're too heavy to carry.
Yeah, moving is not a good time to have a lot of books.
No.
We recommend bags instead of boxes. That's easier, but continue.
Yeah, they're so heavy. So I have a library subscriptions in Black at the bibliothèque. So I actually borrow quite a few books from them. I always have one at home at least. Mm-hmm. Which is very nice. And then I also lend them from friends, and I also lend or borrow, I guess, them my own. I always like it. If I'm visiting a friend, I always look at their bookshelves. That's my favorite thing to do. So that's, I guess, how I also acquire them. When I'm home at my parents, I also look at their collection. But to be honest, yeah, I don't know. They read a lot of like old stuff.
All right.
And what do you, in which language do you read now? Do you have a preference?
Well, right now I mostly read in English. That's a bit about availability of the books, both at the library, but at the bookshops here. I do like reading in Italian, but it just doesn't happen as often. And also I am not always as patient waiting for like the translation, because I am very much, I watch a lot of BookTube. So like YouTube content on books. So I'm also kind of in tune with what's coming up or what's coming out right now. So then I also just want to read it.
Do you have these writers, authors that you follow from the beginning and just have to read the next book whenever it comes out?
Yeah, sort of. They're mostly, I'm not really into the fantasy, for example, genre. And those are the ones I usually have like follow-up books, but I am really a big rom-com fan.
So
the Emily Henry of this world, and you know, I just find it really nice, and I know I have a couple of authors that I know I will always enjoy what they write. So
That's nice. Yeah. And do you pay attention to the nationality of the author? Because I can imagine, especially when you consume a lot of BookTube, it's usually quite dominated by American and English writers, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I try to keep an eye on it. Mm. To be honest, because I've decided to like not buy books from like Amazon or even Bold.com anymore if I can.
Very good, I think.
I then only kind of like I can buy what's at the donor.
I can get it for you.
Good selection.
Maybe sometime.
But I think it's very important to diversify in that sense because indeed, like there's, I mean, most content that we consume in general is quite North American and sometimes gives you a bit of a skewed perception, right?
I think of the world. Yeah.
And did your research influence the way that you started reading fiction or what you read?
Yeah, so I think interestingly, it went the other way around. So I really remember that when I was about like 15, 16, I was reading all these fiction books around like the women in, for example, in the Middle East and like in Southeast Asia. And then I started thinking, oh, this is very interesting. But they were all fiction books. But they triggered something in me in terms of curiosity. And there was a whole phase, and my parents can confirm, where I had all these books about like, oh, how women are treated in these specific places and in specific cultures. Now, looking back, those were a bit of a black and white books perhaps, and they were not very nuanced, and maybe they were not very, very informed, but they were something, right? And they definitely made me curious, and so that's also how I got a bit more into the topic. And so the second book I brought here actually is a book I bumped into in a book store in the north of Italy, where I was with my grandparents. I kind of accompanied them for their summer holiday. And then I got like a couple hours to myself and I went to this bookstore in this very small village and I found this book, which is called Half the Sky.
By whom is it and when was it written?
So Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun. I have to check the...
It's quite recent, I think.
Yeah, well, I think early 2000s.
Mm. Ah, okay.
2009, I think.
Right.
Well, that's not early 2000, but... I just think it's so crazy that I bumped into this by chance. So it's, of course, it's a very well-known book in the US. But I mean, I was in the middle of nowhere in Italy.
In the village.
And they had a translation of this book. And this I still have in Rome. So my parents have it. And the subtitle of this book is Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And I found out about this subtitle only recently. I reread it, and my master thesis subtitle was Turning Taboo into Opportunity.
Wow.
And I was like, this has been in the back of my mind for 15 years, and I just forgot about it. And basically, these are two journalists who have been traveling all around the world, and basically they have been interested in kind of shining light on how women are oppressed worldwide and what we can do to turn them into like empowered economic agents. Now, I have a more critical view of this book right now than I did 15 years ago, of course. But I remember, and I still have a journal entry of when I started reading this book. So you can understand, I was a very like meta person, even as a young person. And I remember being completely like fired up. I read this and I thought, oh my God, this is what I wanna do with my life. Like I wanna dedicate my life to indeed like turning this oppression into an opportunity. And perhaps I can just like read a couple of sentences from the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very short, but I think it's the call to action of the authors really struck a chord with me, and I remember feeling very excited, although the topic is, of course, quite heavy because there's a lot around like sex slavery and human trafficking in the book. But basically, the author kind of end the introduction but saying, let us be clear about this upfront. We hope to recruit you to join an incipient movement to emancipate women and fight global poverty by unlocking women's power as economic catalysts. That is the process underway, not a drama of victimization, but of empowerment. the kind that transforms bubbly teenage girls from brothel slaves into successful businesswomen. This is a story of transformation. It is change that is already taking place and change that can accelerate if you'll just open your heart and join in.
Well, that fires you up. That's very, I don't know, probably the wrong word, but class Marxist based, which I like about it, right?
Yeah. Mm. Then the book goes, forward to be a little bit, I don't know if orientalist is the right word to say, but, you know, just me and us and we and you and the Americans and the Muslims and, you know, and I think now I would recommend reading this book with a critical eye. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think for me it was so important because it was the first time that I really got an extended piece of content that was presenting data, which really translates to what I do now. So I was really, this is not just voices and not just people's experiences, but this is like a comprehensive story of women across the world who are being oppressed, mutilated, and, you know, marginalized because they're women. And so that I just remember this is just like really a watershed moment for me. And I remember where I was. I remember where I was when I was reading it again with the mountain view.
Ah, you remember as well.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I'm just thinking like how we now learn that fiction like sort of led you towards this research. Mm-hmm. And now we've talked about the book that really like was this watershed moment.
Yeah.
So I'm getting curious about the third book that you brought.
Yeah.
Maybe it can become full circle or it's completely different. Tell us.
Yeah.
Which book is it?
Yeah, so the third book is called Period Power by Maisie Hill. And the subtitle is Harness Your Hormones and Get Your Cycle Working for You.
Must also be quite recent, right?
Yeah, it was published at the end of 2019 or beginning of 2020.
Ah, okay.
And so the interesting reason I brought this book is, of course, it relates very much to my research because I research basically how menstrual health is a key stepping stone to gender equality and what organizations and companies can do about it. But I also work with Maisie. So Maisie is my coach and mentor, and I've met her the day she presented her book in the Netherlands. So I went on my own to Amsterdam just before the pandemic started. So it was, I think, January 2020, 15th of January, something like that.
Yeah.
I went on my own. So this is autographed, actually.
I have an autographed copy.
Yeah. And she said, thank you so much for coming today and for helping to spread the word about Period Power. And the funny thing is, you asked me before, have you ever recorded a podcast? And I have, twice, with Maisie. I was
cool.
on her podcast a couple of times, and she's become over the years a mentor for me. And that was the first time we met in person, was for her a book presentation in the Netherlands.
Very nice. So this copy of this book probably is an exception among your books in that you want to
to keep, absolutely. Yeah.
And you had read the book prior to meeting her.
So I had read the book, and I think I was one of the few people there who had, because the translation in Dutch, and in Dutch the book is called The Cycle Strategy, and it had just come out as she was presenting it. So I think most people hadn't bought the book yet. So I went up to her after to ask for the author. And when we talked a few years later, and she said, oh, I do remember you. She said, I do remember that there was this person who was very enthusiastic and had a lot of
full
energy.
Of anticipation.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And I mean, basically the content of the book is really about encouraging women and people who have menstrual cycles to understand their body better, what they can do to support their body and their mind if they have menstrual pain or menstrual conditions, but also it's very, very mindful in not asking women to be any different than they are from themselves and to recognize that a lot of times we feel bad about menstruation because of the messaging we received and not because menstruation is per se bad or disgusting. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot also about stepping into your power and recognizing that it's hard sometimes to be someone who's been socialized as a woman because there's a lot of thoughts and beliefs around women being hysterical or hormonal or untrustworthy because they fluctuate. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's very cool that the books you brought almost show how your thinking has developed growing up.
Definitely. Yeah. There's a red thread, I would say. No pun intended. But
no, but you're a good pun. Because maybe we shouldn't talk about this, but this is also discussed, like the current discussion about contraception and mm-hmm. women being critical about...
Mm-hmm. About the pill?
Yeah. It's already in there in 2019.
Yeah, so this has been going on for a few years. Actually, it's good that you mentioned this because I'm writing something about that at the moment. Absolutely. So I think there's definitely been a call, and also in the Netherlands as well, right? I have a lot of people around me who have started questioning hormonal birth control. Mm-hmm. And I would like to say, I think it's so important to guarantee access to free hormonal birth control mm-hmm. for anyone who needs it. And the most critical part of it is informed choice. And that's very difficult to reach because science is not perfect and it's been sexist for a long time. So we have, you know, systematically underestimated the negative impact of birth control on women. We have not put enough funding in male birth control, and there's mm-hmm. so much, you know, social strata there. It's very difficult to get to a good outcome.
And the development of the pill as well, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that it's not that different from the first pill that came onto the market in, the 70s.
No.
When in other medication, there's a lot more development, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, when it comes, a lot of people ask me, like, where do you stand? I've worked for organizations that really work day in and day out to guarantee reproductive rights for women all around the world. So for me, it's like the most important thing is that women have a choice and they are supported. The problem is that having access to birth control that makes them feel depressed or you know, poses health risks to them is not informed choice, or it's not the optimal outcome I would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to see more money and more research into better forms of birth control, still keeping, you know, access and information about the current options absolutely available.
Yeah.
But I think we should always stay critical just because it's worked so far and women have stuck with it because, they want to have control over their bodies. Doesn't mean that we're done. The work is not done.
A lot of research to be done still.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow. Well, thanks very much for giving us this insight in your reading history. And we would like to know if maybe you have one final tip, maybe something you're currently reading or have recently read that you would like to recommend to our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, it's not per se a recent read, but it is one of my favorite authors is indeed Brené Brown.
Ah, okay.
So there's all her bibliography, to be honest, I think is really recommendable. She's really a leader in writing things that the general public can understand, but she's very much informed by her research on courage and shame. Mm-hmm. And I just love her books. And I think everyone can really benefit from a little bit more courage these days.
Now with the elections, I should shut up. Yeah. Thank you very much for being our guest today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You listen to a podcast by the Rotterdams Leeskabinet, your humanities library at Campus Woudestein.